It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 upfront payment equivalent to $15 per month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Taxes and fees extra. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes. See details.
This is The Guardian.
I know it sounds like a bridge too far, but it strikes me that if we could think more about the way we do politics as community sport rather than just watching the NRL or the AFL, you probably can end up with a more productive democracy.
Hi, I'm Amy Remakis, Guardian Australia's political reporter and politics live blogger, coming to you from the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri peoples. It's the Guardian Essential edition of the Australian Politics Podcast, so I'm here with the Executive Director of Essential Media, Peter Lewis. Hello, Peter.
Hello, Amy.
We've got a lot to talk about in this podcast, in a special guest appearance with me, given that Paul Karp is off sojourning in Europe at the moment. But with the attempted assassination of Donald Trump and continued calls for Joe Biden to step down, some of us might be inclined to think that Australian politics is relatively stable and steady. But this fortnight's Guardian Essential report reveals that voters' dissatisfaction with the state of democracy in Australia and the motivation of our politicians, well, it runs very deep. It's in a bit of decay, I think we can say there. So, Peter, to get us started, how are we feeling about democracy in Australia? Do we think that our democracy is working?
Not great. and look, you know, sometimes events conspire to make a set of questions incredibly relevant, and we run a 2-week political cycle. So we put these questions in the field at the beginning of last week. I don't think, you know, the events of the last week is sort of, it's consistent with what's happening in, you know, America. Like, are we different? I think, you know, these numbers suggest Australia is US without the guns, you know. On democracy, we have 37% of people saying they're satisfied with the state of democracy, about the same number, 30% saying they're not, with 28% in the middle. But when you go down a couple of layers into the elements that make up democracy, federal parliament, more people dissatisfied than satisfied, 29% in the satisfied bracket, 43% in the dissatisfied. And then when you ask what they think about political debate, which is more their interaction and what they're seeing out of the corner of their eye, it's only 25% satisfied with what they're seeing, 49% dissatisfied. What does this all add up to? I think there's, you know, a call and response going on here. If, you know, you're closer to it, Amy, like the parliamentary session kind of ended, and from my cheap seats I was seeing conflict over Gaza, a nuclear outbreak on climate change, silly buggers with the NDIS, like nothing seemed to be moving. So these things don't surprise me, but it's also against the backdrop of, you know, this cost of living call and response where everyone says it's their biggest issue and it kind of feels like it's outside the capability of government to deal with it. So I think there's a few things going on. There's kind of the mission of government, there's the behaviour inside the parliament, and then out of all that comes, so what is democracy and is whatever this system is working? And I'm not sort of wanting to put on the Aaron Sorkin soundtrack behind me or anything. It just feels like...
Please don't.
You know, if you talk about the vibe of politics, and I don't know if there was ever a halcyon day, but it feels like it's at an ebb at the moment.
I mean, it is interesting, and we've spoken a lot in Guardian podcasts about, you know, what the cost of living crisis is doing. But it just kind of feels like if you're a millennial or younger, you have lived through quite a lot of historical events already, and we're already, you know, fatigued with historical events. Throw in another cost of living crisis, throw in just sort of dissatisfaction with how your politicians respond to that. It doesn't seem that outrageous that people are just kind of skeptical and just tired of how everything is playing out. And we saw that in some of the polling, because one of the things that we're very skeptical about is why we think politicians entered the game in the first place, aren't we?
Yeah. Just on the generational difference, a bit of a counterintuitive. Young people by about 10% more likely to feel satisfied with the state of the various pieces, democracy, federal party, and politics. But we also did offer all voters or respondents to our essential report a binary, which is closer to your view. Most politicians enter politics to serve the public interest. Cue the West Wing soundtrack again. Most politicians enter into politics to serve their own interests. Cue the swamp. It's 75-25 to the swamp. Again, on age, slightly more positive young people, but by saying that, it's 72-28. And no real difference in gender. So, look, in a way, that's kind of a mean question because it sets up a common trope, but it is worth testing out. Like, sometimes we're testing the messages in politics as well. The big outlier in those results, though, and again, hardly surprising, if you vote for a minor party or independents, it's 85-15 that they're just in it for themselves.
Wow. That is, I mean, not surprising, but very binary.
Yeah.
When you look at it like that.
And I guess, you know, if you vote for independent, you're voting there because most politicians aren't your people. So, like, underneath the
discontent?
Yeah, underneath the seething discontent around democracy, the other story playing out is the decline in support of major parties, right? So, you know, when I was young, it was probably, you know, pretty much an even split between the major parties. You get about 10% that were uncommitted. That's up to 30% now. So there is a fracturing of the system. And again, you know, when you talk to people about what is democracy, some people, older people, probably look at it still as a two-party system. Other people sort of want to see more out of their democracy. Is it just turning up to vote every 3 years, or is there something that more that people want out of it, which talks to some of the questions that we'll get to in a little while?
Yeah, I mean, like, to go back to your point about you saying if you're voting independent, then most politicians aren't necessarily your cup of tea anyway. I was going to ask, is it actually most politicians, or is it the two-party system isn't your cup of tea?
Yeah, well, we didn't ask that question, but I think they're voting with their feet away from the major parties. But there's more people that are seeing, I do read both the rise of right-wing fringe parties and the Teal Independents, and for that matter, the Greens, all being a symptom of people not getting out of the major parties what they want. And, you know, there is a call and response there, as we said before. I also think that we're in a particularly difficult time to govern. I don't think government is, incumbency at the moment is an advantage. I think this is part of that global trend that says that government can't be trusted and everyone's in it for themselves. And we're just filling out that picture here, I think. And I don't think it's helped by the way that both media is being drawn into conflict-driven reporting, like nothing new, but hyper-conflict, I think, and also the way the digital platforms amplify conflict because it's the fuel that keeps them working. I don't think it's outside the context of the rest of the things going on, which is, you know, a little bit what that report that the Home Affairs Minister put out this week was trying to make the point that this is in a broader context, right?
Yeah, and I'm excited to get to the Strengthening Democracy report because there's a couple of interesting tidbits in there, and that's a task force that Claire O'Neill set up as a Home Affairs Minister to basically go have a look at democracy around the world, have a look at democracy in Australia, and what do we need to do to strengthen our democracy? And that was set up in 2023. So it was interesting that the government's mind was already at, well, we're seeing a fracturing of democracy around the world. How is this going to come across in Australia, what's going to play out in Australia, given where we are now and the world events that we're seeing now. It was actually almost ahead of its time, I suppose. But again, the people moving away from the major parties, you did ask the question, you know, do you think that it's going to be best after the election to have either a hung parliament or having a single party in government? Essentially, that was your question. It was much better worded the way you guys did it.
I know you're offering me a Dorothy Dixer and I kind of just played for time. I'm sorry, Amy. No, we did put this one up as a choice with a don't know in the middle. So the two options were it is better for a single party to have a majority in parliament and form government by itself, or it's better for no single party to have a majority in parliament and to negotiate with other parties or independents. It's kind of like 42 for a majority party, 38 for a party being forced to negotiate, and 20% unsure. So I do think it's going to be one of the, I don't think it's going to be the centre of the next election, but I think it's going to be one of the, you know, melodies that's going on under the surface, because I think there is one theory of what happens next where if the Labor government loses some seats, they end up in minority, and that becomes a reason for the coalition to argue that they shouldn't, you know, be forming a government with these terrible people. It makes it hard, but there's no clear read from the public here. I'm just going to look and see if there's any older people much more certain that they want a majority party in charge, 56-29, whereas younger people, it's 48-30 in favour of being forced into a minority, which is kind of consistent with younger people more likely to be voting away from the major parties.
Yeah, and we know that always when it comes to federal elections, that one of the main messages is that, you know, stability is key, that majority is absolutely essential to having a strong parliament and a strong government. But this is kind of pointing to a trend that we have been seeing with voters where they're like, actually, maybe you having to negotiate with some independents who we agree with on, you know, foundational issues wouldn't necessarily be such a bad thing. And we're already seeing that play out in the Senate, you know, where the government, if it can't get the coalition's agreement on something, has to negotiate with quite a progressive Senate crossbench. But it does look like the scare messages around hung parliament perhaps are not going to be quite as potent this time around. Is that your takeaway?
I just think it's one of those debates where you've got kind of, you know, 40 each side and 20 in the middle. It's still to be run and won. Like I don't want to predict how it plays out. There's a base on each side. But, you know, the minor parties are in the business of building power outside the majority, and then you've got the two major parties who are in the business of forming government. The challenge for the major parties is their share of the electorate is dropping. It's a really valid, in talking about, you know, democracy as we did at the beginning, what do we mean by democracy? Like, is coalitions of a whole bunch of different stakeholders a different version of democracy? I noted that Claire O'Neill last night was talking about democracy not being locked into the one process and it needing to evolve. Now, that's really hard when we can't change our constitution, right? But it doesn't mean that the parliamentary democracy and the one vote every 3 years is the only form of democracy. And there's some really interesting ideas floating around at the moment about how you build more deliberation into day-to-day life so it's not just a ballot box every 3 years and that's your only input. So, you know, I think I thought obviously the timing both with our poll and the release of the government's lined up with this sort of moment. I think a lot of people are still processing and what it means. But if it gets us to think not just about the binary of democracy or dictatorship, but what does good democracy look like that's not a that's important. And I think if part of the discussions in the lead up to the next election go to that, it's not unproductive. I think where people turn off politics back to the earliest is when everyone hates on everyone else. You know, are your competitors your enemies? And the extent to which we've created a political culture where It's that sense of, you know, the fight. Like I liken it to, you know, we watch politics like we watch sport, that we cheer for our side and we boo the other side and we have disdain for the ref and we cast moral judgment on those we don't agree with. And does that get us the democracy we want? I don't know.
It might be something that our representatives have to reckon with, though, as they, you know, slide in this final year down towards the next election. But in that report that you were mentioning that Claire O'Neill launched at the Museum of Modern Democracy, Strengthening Democracy, they were speaking about how 70% of the world's population now lives under some form of autocratic rule. And so Claire O'Neill's main point that she was making in her speech, it seemed to be, is like, we need to make sure that we protect Australia's democracy and that Australia can work to try and boost democracy around the world. But she also had a lot of warnings about some of the things that you're mentioning and the protests that are going on and the way that these protests are carrying out and those sorts of things. And I just wonder, with the results that we've seen here, as well as everything that's going on, is that message that the way that you're protesting is just not good enough, is that actually going to change people's minds about their democracy? From that report that we were reading, both read last night, as well as like from these results, is telling people that, you know, doing sit-ins and, you know, getting rowdy, that's not how we protest in Australia. Is that actually going to change hearts and minds?
Look, I don't want to. I think there's a difference between saying conflict is bad, like politics is conflict, right? You know, I'm from a union background, anger, hope, action. We start it with the point of conflict. You know, passion to drive social change is really, really important. I just think that if you look at the common thread across the world, it's all our both democracies and non-democracies are anchored by these global digital platforms who make their money out of getting people angry and dividing us into little groups. And I think there is a tendency towards the totalitarian in the technology that we're all basing our civic discourse on. So I know that's bigger than, you know, the way we run elections or whatever, but I do think that these are features, not bugs, of the way that the public spaces are built today. And a weaker media who are also reliant on the platforms to distribute the information, people that are being, you know, reinforced with their views rather than given the nuance, I think that's all part of it. So I'm not against protest, you know. My day job is running political campaigns for change, but I do think that there is a hyper conflict at the heart of what mid-21st century democracy looks like, which isn't serving us well and makes it quite brittle.
So what can bring us together? I mean, what are we feeling good about in the poll that you just did?
Well, yeah, we before all this, I thought this was going to be a discussion about the Olympics, actually, because they're starting in a week. So we originally, one of the things that we'd thought was that we'd line up the way we look at politics and the way we look at sport. And just one of the things I think that you can learn off sport is that while a lot of people watch it, there's also a lot of people that play it. And the way you play sport is that if you're in a local soccer club or a netball team or you play golf, yes, you compete, but you also hang out afterwards. And I know it sounds like a bridge too far, but it strikes me that if we could think more about the way we do politics as community sport rather than just watching the NRL or the AFL, you probably can end up with a more productive democracy. So park that. What we like is sport, though, right?
I should probably add in there that I no longer play community sport because I was too competitive for community sport and just took it a little bit too seriously. So perhaps not everybody who plays community sport is quite as community-minded as some of the people you know
who play community sport. Well, yeah, I play with the Newtown Browns and we come out two times a year to play cricket very badly and we all enjoy each other's company. But
there's a reason I'm not allowed to hold a hockey stick anymore. Let's just put it that way.
So you played hockey like a Guardian journalist, fiercely.
Yes, I did play hockey like a Guardian journalist. And also like a Russian-Lithuanian, which, you know, adds a little bit more fuel to the fire there as well.
Multiple identities.
Yeah, that's me.
Gravitating to a hockey stick.
All of my personalities coming out for community sport.
What
and
a
it
meme.
Was not We'd, pretty.
We didn't put hockey on the list, but we did have the Olympics, and I do believe we play hockey at the Olympics, so you'll be tuning in. But we asked people what sports they watch in the Olympics. Is out there, 48% of people say they'll be following it. Interestingly, people that say they've got low engagement in sports still watch the Olympics, unlike other sports, which is almost axiomatic. The other things we like watching, 40% of us follow the AFL, 36% tennis, 33% cricket. We forget there's a lot of people that don't, but there is a hell of a lot of people that are 17% said I don't watch any sport. So the vast majority has something there. And then of those, 35% bet on it as well. 11% regularly and 24% occasionally. So we like sport. Quite a few of us like betting on sport. And I thought the other thing, the last thing that we asked this week where there was a significant increase, and I don't know if we need national therapy on this. Every Olympic, we ask people, how important is it that Australia wins gold? And it's the highest it's ever been. 64% says
well,
it's
really
important,
need that hero
30%
arc,
not important. So, you know, in 2012, which was a long time ago, I can't even name where the Olympics were held in 2012, but it was 54 that we don't really care and 44 that it mattered. It went up to 51-43 in 2016, and then we had that long break for COVID, and it was only 3 years ago, the last one, 2021, where it was 53-41. So a big uptake in our need for national self-validation through the acquisition of precious metals in Paris.
But, I mean, like, that is the Olympics, though, isn't it? It is, you know, the national sort of heroic story. Everyone gets behind the story that is being crafted in front of you through this contest.
Yeah. But don't you reckon a lot of people just tally it up and they just want to get to the top of the table as well? So that first week, they're tallying it up in the pool and they're getting to like, oh, you know, we've won 10 gold. And then they're trying to sort of eke away three or four, maybe one in canoeing and something on a field
event. My favourite is also always how when we do it the per capita, like Australia would be in the top two if we did it per capita instead
apart from Kazakhstan,
you know,
who's really good at weightlifting. Yeah.
I was actually surprised to read in, you know, when I was going through the results, the Olympics is in a week because I don't feel that the hype on the ground is as big as it has been. So I was actually surprised to see that there were so many people cottoned on to the fact that, you know, we're all about to tune into Paris.
And I wonder, given Claire O'Neill's report again, whether that sort of myth of a happy world of nations is fracturing. Like I'm interested in what the vibe's going to be. Like it's kind of weird with, I suspect in America, which is like ground zero for Olympic acquisition of gold matter, like what's happening there is going to, I don't know if they're going to have the headspace for what's going on in Paris. Russia doesn't compete as Russia. I don't know. Like I think, I don't know. Is it was the Olympics this dream of a global village which is being fractured by the things we've been talking about earlier in this discussion?
And yet they held the Olympics during World War II.
They did. They held it just beforehand in Berlin.
Yeah. So, Adolf. I mean, you know, we have managed to hold it during a time of world fractioning. I am seeing quite a lot of stories about Palestinian athletes who will be competing in the Olympics. That's what is filtering through to me. And it does seem like there is, you know, people getting behind people who they feel are oppressed at the moment as well. It's not necessarily nation building I'm seeing out there, at least in my social feeds, about their own nation.
Are they hating on Israeli
athletes
as well?
No, they're not hating on Israeli
athletes,
not that I've seen. It's more like we need to get behind these people and also like let their cause come to the world stage in a way that perhaps it hasn't over the last 9 months. Mm. So that is what's showing up in my social feed. So it was just kind of interesting. Mm. And then I had to look up the Paris, you know, Olympics and how they're all going.
Cliche.
Where I saw the logo and it absolutely shocked me. I then had to go check and see whether it was a spoof logo because it's meant to be a flame that is also a woman. But the woman has quite a, let's say...
Would you say mullet?
I would say middle-aged woman of a certain attitude type. She's asking for the manager, this logo. She's absolutely asking to see your manager. And I think, actually, I was like, is this Tinder? Is this, like, graphic design is my passion? This is what Paris has come up with as their 2024 Olympic logo that's going to be there in history for however long the world has left.
I reckon there's definitely a long column in this one, Amy. I've never seen anyone read so much into both the Olympic torch and the way it might look like a woman's head, but that's terrific.
Well, I think that anyone who has not actually seen the logo yet should go and look it up and
you'll
let
never
us
unsee
know,
it. Yeah.
Let us know what it is that you see. It can be your own personal personality test. I saw a woman then had to extrapolate that out to see the flame, and I wondered why Paris was being represented.
See, I looked at it and I saw the flame first, and it was only when you started talking about Karen.
About middle-aged women haircuts.
that I saw it. But I maybe that's it's not the silliest Olympic design ever. Like, do you remember some of the, like, the mascots, including Sydney's own, which I think were...
We had a platypus and an echidna and stuff, right?
I kept thinking just of... Yeah, Wally the Fat Ass Wombat, but that was Roy Nation.
Yeah, I was going to say that was the spoof version, but yeah. Look, a lot of people get a lot of money to design the worst mascots in the world, and it's not a talent that I particularly hold, so I probably shouldn't be passing judgment.
But isn't it much more fun talking about sport than politics? Like.
Yes, it is, but perhaps not quite as consequential, although sport and politics has always been mixed together and we've always seen social justice movements promoted by sport and athletes, and the Olympic has been home to many, many historical and iconic moments that have, you know, brought attention to all sorts of causes and have made heroes out of the everyday. So,
and of course, the interesting final, Amy, is whether a gold rush equates to any uptick in voter satisfaction with the status quo and the government. There is a long theory that government support goes up over summer because everyone's lying on the beach having a good time. If we smash it out of the park, will that be good for our Prime Minister as well?
Well, I mean, like, yeah, it's absolutely true that when we're not thinking about our politicians,
we
generally tend to feel a little bit more favourably towards them. But on that note, thank you very much, Peter, for talking us through the latest Guardian Essential poll. And this episode was produced by Cinnamon Nippard and Alison Chan. The executive producer is Miles Martignoni.
We all have dreams. Dream home renovations, dream vacations, or sending our kids to their dream colleges. But finding straightforward ways to turn those dreams into realistic goals, that's where things get tricky. Merrill understands that. That's why, with a dedicated Merrill advisor, you get a personalized plan and a clear path forward. And having the bull at your back helps your whole financial life move with you. So when your plans change, Merrill is with you every step of the way. Go to ml.com/bullish to learn more. Merrill, a Bank of America company. What would you like the power to do? Investing involves risk. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith Incorporated, registered broker-dealer, registered investment advisor, member SIPC.
Let's talk about something that's not always top of mind, but still really important. Life insurance. Why? Because it offers financial protection for your loved ones and can help them pay for things like a mortgage, credit card debt. It can even help fund an education. And guess what? Life insurance is probably a lot more affordable than you think. In fact, most people think life insurance is 3 times more expensive than it is. So with State Farm Life Insurance, you can protect your loved ones without breaking the bank. Not sure where to start? State Farm has over 19,000 local agents that can help you choose an option to fit your needs and budget. Get started today and contact a State Farm agent or go to statefarm.com.